Welcome to the Reach Out podcast, the show where we explore how researchers at Aalborg University and elsewhere use digital technologies to disseminate their knowledge, as well as connect with different audiences. This podcast is supported by generous funding from the Digitalization Strategy at Aalborg University Denmark and produced at Aalborg University Business School. If you want to connect, follow us on Twitter at reachout, that's reachout with A-A-U-T in the end. And now let's jump straight into the interview.
Welcome to the Reach Out podcast series. Today I'm here with David from the Department of Communication and Psychology. And David, you're a professor in research communication, so you're quite the expert in this field.
Yeah, let's see about that.
So today will be a kind of meta dialogue about both your own research communication and the research of research dissemination and how you see other researchers doing it. So first of all, could you tell us a bit about how you communicate your research? Do you have a communication strategy and how do you go about it?
Well, thank you for having me on the podcast. Actually, in our own research, I don't have an explicit communication strategy that we are planning in advance. But being the lead and the co-director of the Humanomics Research Center, obviously, we do have quite an extensive communication effort. So what we do is we are prioritizing communication and dissemination of results continuously, and we are putting effort into making sure that our research is also reaching other audiences. So rather than only communicating to our peers, which obviously is an important platform for being a researcher, we are also trying to open up science and communicating in other formats. So every time we have a new paper or there is a new book out, we will also make sure to try to write up an opinion piece for a newspaper, use social media platforms, and also trying to develop, more easily accessible digests. So that may be a newsletter or a email basically to our stakeholders, to our funders, to collaborators, in which I would then try to explain our research in a non-technical fashion.
So that's a joint effort for the research group or the...
So what we are doing in our research center or in our research group is basically we, as you said before, we're doing a lot of research on research. And given the fact that we are organized around myself as a director and my co-director, Frederik Stjernfeld, I guess it's safe to say that we are quite exposed to Danish media and to the media landscape, including the social media landscape, in advance. So me and Frederik have always been using media outreach and public dissemination of our research as a platform, both to generate new ideas actually and get feedback, but obviously also to communicate. So I think for some of our younger researchers and early career researchers, they might think that me and Frederik often are the ones responsible for communicating, but I'm also encouraging our early career researchers to do their own communication. So I have a couple of examples of that. So one thing is that if we are doing, let's say, for example, an opinion piece or a newsletter on research being conducted within the center, I'll make sure to make some of our early career researchers co-authors. So basically, even though I may be the lead author and also the one giving the interviews or going to the television or the radio, I would still try to promote our early career researchers, also to give them a sense of what it means to actually be exposed and to be able to explain your research to a larger audience. So we've done that on numerous occasions. I've been co-editing and co-authoring quite a lot of pieces with our younger researchers, which then fortunately have been picked up by other journalists who have then invited some of our early career researchers onto their podcast radio programs and also been invited to author their own opinion pieces, more specifically in their own area of expertise. So I think these things follow quite nicely together, but for me and Frederik, it's always been a priority, as I said before, to try to use the public, as it were, as an important partner and stakeholder in our research.
And I guess that's also creating a mindset around early career researchers to actually use and build competencies in communicating right. this way?
So one of the key topics that I have been researching for the last 10 years has been to try to come up with better frameworks and methodologies for creating what we call impact of research. So that is to try to find new ways of translating, implementing, and also synthesizing research for a broader audience so that not only our own research in the center, but also the research at the university and also at other universities and funding agencies are being translated into formats and into outputs that can actually be absorbed and used by different audiences. We've also developed indicators trying to measure those types of outputs that might not be captured by patents or licenses or startup companies, but rather, as it were, are captured by activities, by interactions. And I think it's important for people like ourselves to sort of walk the talk so that when we are creating new research on research, and now in this case, in particular on the research impact side of things, public dissemination, third mission activities, we also need to get those messages across ourselves. So I would say that it has been a key priority in my own career for actually the last numerous years to have a quite ambitious communication effort and to make sure that our results are being translated and reaching other audiences. So that has, you know, that has a lot of implications of how to manage my time. I'm not only conducting research or managing a research group, but also taking time to write up articles and blog posts and opinion pieces for broader audiences, and also being a career researcher nowadays is already quite an extensive job, and I'm also the father of two small children. But I do make sure also to engage with journalists, to engage with policymakers, which has also been a key kind of area of interest from our research. Who wants to know more of how to then themselves promote research impact, promote new models of science communication. So that has for myself meant that often I have been giving as many, if not more presentations to stakeholders, non-academic stakeholders, rather than only presenting conference papers at academic events. And the same also goes for the media outreach. You know, journalists can be quite cannibalistic. The moment you get on their radar, they have a tendency to start coming back, and they often want more. And the moment you gave one interview in one area of research, other journalists are quickly picking it up, and then they are starting contacting you. And that's a quite delicate balance to strike, because you need to both take time off to do your research, to nurture your research group, but at the same time also communicating what you're actually developing. And I guess it's in our case, it's been kind of a fortunate kind of cross-fertilization. You know, the more we communicate externally, the more interest and uptake we see of our research, which fortunately also spills over into better funding opportunities and better dialogue with our funders. At the same time, my own experience has been that this also gives rise to new research questions, to new research interests. For example, relating to the last year, so you can imagine doing research on research communication obviously has been kind of trending for the last 12 to 16 months because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And here there has been a huge interest in understanding and becoming better at communicating research, for example, to authorities, policymakers, but also journalists and the public at large. And I think it's worthwhile in a situation like this to take a step back, and rather than only focusing on chunking out more papers, also take the time to do the public service and be present in the public discourse and trying to understand how can we tweak our research in a way that makes sense for a broader audience. So just this week, now with the AstraZeneca vaccine program being on a pause, you know, I have been contacted by numerous journalists who wants to try to find out how can you communicate scientific uncertainties to citizens. And I would be honest to say that basically I'm not a researcher on vaccine hesitancy or vaccine communication, but I do have parts of my research that have kind of overlapping areas of interest and areas of expertise. So I do know quite a bit about how to communicate scientific uncertainties and how to open up the scientific process to external audiences. And this can then be tweaked or, if you like, translated into a story that also relates to vaccine hesitancy or vaccine uptake. So here, you know, I go back to my desk and do some, do a little bit more research on vaccination communication and health communication than I would normally do. Not to write up an academic article, but to be able to communicate what we're already conducting research on in a way that's relating to the current agenda. So this is kind of an example of a situation in which I would then try to add new layers to my own research in order to become better at communicating it in an emergency situation like the current one.
But I guess the way you tell this story, it's also this fine line or the balance that you need to create between your research time and the time you spent disseminating and adjusting the way you do research to the communication that non-academics are interested in. So how do you go about that? It must take a lot of time, as you also said. Do you have any help or any resources that you can use in trying to get some of these things out, articles, small pieces that communicate more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, so I think first of all, it's important to also make the distinction about career levels, because when you're an early career researcher, which I guess I was myself up until recently, actually, you know, I would also be a little bit more cautious and make sure that I would only communicate my expertise in a way that I could substantiate with, let's say, peer-reviewed research, like speak within my own area of speciality or expertise. But what happens when you build up an academic career and you become more mature is also you become a little bit more, let's say, self-sufficient. You know that your expertise is also reaching out to other areas, that there are might be borderline issues that you can extend your expertise also to include. So there you wouldn't be, as it were, communicating on top of specific projects or even on top of specific publications. Perhaps you wouldn't even be able to substantiate your communications with reference to, let's say, specific peer-reviewed publications, but you would talk more with the authority of being an expert. And that means that you would have kind of this synthetic overview of an entire research area, and you would try to pick out which elements from that research area could be useful for your audience, giving a particular interest or a particular, let's say, demand or request for input. And so here I would draw more broadly upon, you know, my expertise as a professor as a researcher at a Danish university, obviously with a speciality within communication and the psychology of science communication. But I wouldn't too much hesitate also to speak more broadly in that domain rather than always making sure that I could relate to peer-reviewed literature, which I guess is a difference, because this I would have been more hesitant doing in my earlier career, where I would also sometimes, you know, go to more, let's say, non-academic events and talk to non-academic audiences. But I would always also try to at least accommodate and make sure that my technical details would be in place, and that I wouldn't speak too far out of my own area of expertise. So this has something to do with maturing as a science communicator and becoming a little bit more secure in the role as a communicator. And then, you know, and so this also has a lot to do with practice. So if I'm, for example, so I can give you one example of a strategy that we adopt for communication. So one thing is obviously to try to find out which parts of your research might be of interest to a broader audience. So you might, we have been like publishing, let's say, quite technical articles on the sociology of science, where we have been doing large survey studies and doing, you know, semantic network analysis and doing, you know, quite technical papers that are not of interest to a lot of members of the public, but mainly to members of the scientific community. So here I would say, okay, let's put it out there, put, you know, a quick post on Twitter and see if some colleagues will pick it up. But I wouldn't put too much effort into it. Mm-hmm. Rather, if you have, for example, a new book or a new research project that has been funded, as we have this week, actually, tomorrow I'm launching a new research project, a new 10-year long research project. So here it's a totally different story. Here we need to exploit both social media and traditional media. So here I would make the effort to write up a press release. I would definitely make sure that the university would have a small news mentioning on different websites, both at the department level, at the faculty level, and even at the broader university level. And I would also make sure to try myself if we are doing that continuously, also to put out a small opinion piece, not so much, you know, trying to get attention to the research, but also trying to manage the messages. So you can sit around waiting for someone to see your Twitter post or someone to find your post on Facebook, and then you can respond to that flow of information as it evolves. But what you can also do is you can try to manage your own messages by writing up a small text for a larger audience, and then see if a newspaper would post it. And even if in the case that a newspaper will not post it or publish it, then you can put it on your own website. So here you have a small, let's say, coherent narrative that puts a little bit more context and background to a new, let's say, a new project or a new book that you have been putting out. So again, I don't think there is a one model fits all. It's much about, you know, understanding what parts of your research might be interesting to external audiences and what parts are much more interesting, hopefully, to your academic peers. And not trying to, you know, reverse that order. So if you're trying to push out a lot of technical papers to the general public, you will get quite disappointed. On the other hand, if you're establishing a new network, you know, if you're engaging in a new partnership, if you're having a good case study of a piece of research that you produced that was actually being, you know, taken up by an external stakeholder, company, or policymaker, or, you know, educational program, then you can write that up. So you have a small case study, a small narrative, where you, as a researcher, is able to manage your own message. And that, you know, is not only putting a little bit of data down to your portfolio, you can use that for your CV, but it also makes sure that some of your stakeholders, you know, notice that you actually take them seriously, and that you're proud of those different projects that you're getting, you know, that you're paying tribute to the funding agencies that supported your research, and also that you're doing your civic duty to communicate research proactively. So I think it's much about, you know, and now I'm talking at length here, but I think it's much about finding the bits and pieces that are. You know, more relevant to communicate, and then sometimes just keep the more technical details to yourself and your internal audiences.
And I guess that can also be difficult when you're a researcher, because we are proud of the handiwork and the methods that we use.
Yeah, that's true. So that is a balance. And, you know, in my own case, I was quite, you know, activist. I took a quite activist stance. I very early on thought that the public arena is actually a quite productive space to test new ideas and also to, you know, get ground under the feet. and see what ideas are flying with other stakeholders and what ideas, you know, might not be as relevant. So I was using the public arena, like both the broader, you could say, academic public, so also representatives from other disciplines, but also the public at large as a kind of a testing ground for new research to see, would this fly, would this resonate? And so I guess I have been spending a little bit more time communicating than many other researchers would do. And I guess also then I would encourage other researchers to do, because honestly, I did spend quite a lot of time and energy communicating. But I think that there is a lesson to be learned there, that yes, you do have to produce research and you do have to go through that, you know, tiresome process of publishing and getting peer reviews and, you know, doing your resubmissions and adjusting your research to your peers and the input. And yes, you do have to teach and take a lot of effort in teaching to your students. But on top of that, first of all, it won't hurt your research to communicate it more widely. It might actually, you know, enrich the research. And what you will see also, as I mentioned before, you will get different types of feedback from broader communication efforts than you will get from your students and your peers. So it is quite, let's say, you know, subjective, and it does depend on the research area in which you're, you know, operating, how much communication I would encourage you to do. But if you are in any research area that does have, you know, a public interest, at least, you know, make the effort to respond to that interest. If you are in an environment or research group in which you're doing very basic research, a long time, you know, theory and model development, you might struggle to find those bits and pieces that are interesting for a broader audience. And, you know, you might also accept that this is not, you know, a game that you want to play, that in some periods of your career, you must just actually stay at the desk, stay in the laboratory and you know, and do the research. What you then often will discover is that after finalizing a PhD or after having done extensive postdoc studies, you will emerge, as I said before, as an expert in your field. And in this capacity of being an expert, you might start communicating your research a little bit more broadly. And you might also, which at least was of some value to myself, you might also start attending, you know, to other audiences. So for example, what I've been doing myself, which was a little bit, you know, difficult in the beginning, was actually also to attend to more general science conferences. So for example, going about trying to explain your research to an interdisciplinary audience is already to open up your research. So I've been attending a lot of, let's say, community building conferences like the AAAS in the United States, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is a multidisciplinary conference. So you won't really get credit among your own peers for going there, but you will meet a lot of representatives from other disciplines, including funding agencies, science journalists, you know, also university managers, presidents of universities, and you're interacting with these people and seeing how they relate to your research. So that they are all academics, as it were. So it is a kind of a broader academic public, but it gives you feedback for how to communicate. And the same also in Europe. I myself, you know, spent actually quite some years hosting a very large scale interdisciplinary conference called Euroscience Open Forum, in which we had more than 4,000 delegates in Copenhagen discussing interdisciplinary research and science communication. And again here, you know, I was practicing my own communication skills, not so much toward the broader public, but toward the broader academic public. So there are here different layers. And I was often asked by older professors, so David, why do you do that? You don't really get credit when you're applying for a new professorship or when you're applying for a new grant application. You know, you won't really get the credit for having done all these interdisciplinary open science events. They will only look at your core contributions. But, you know, first of all, I wanted to prove them wrong. I said, you know, this can really not be true, that you're not getting credit for doing community work or for communicating your research more broadly. But what I saw was also that they were wrong. You know, that other peers can appreciate that you're doing community work and that you're building your communicative competences. This is increasingly becoming one of the tools that you need in your toolbox as a modern day researcher. So what I found doing this, kind of, as I said before, from an activist point of view, I just wanted to prove them wrong. You know, I also found that it was quite encouraging. You know, people were coming back, funding agencies, my deans, the head of departments were coming back and they were encouraging it. So sometimes, you know, when I took a half hour off to put out a more extensive opinion piece or blog post, I would see my head of department sharing it. I would see our dean, you know, liking it and sharing it. So, you know, in the end of the day, this is not a zero sum game. It's not about, you know, parting your time between research and communication. I would rather put it this way. You know, it's a plus sum game. So you're adding value to your own research and hopefully you're adding value to our democracy and our society by also communicating your research. What you should be a little bit, you know, what you should put attention to is obviously if people start, you know, inquiring into your research so much so that you no longer have time to conduct new research. So if you find yourself in a situation where you're constantly running around giving input to other people and communicating proactively to a wider audience, then you might actually not do the research necessary to nurture and sustain your own career. And that may be a problem. I would even say you know, to be frank, this has been an issue in my own career. There has been periods in which I have found myself, you know, basically running around from one general science conference to the next, from one ministry to the next, from one, you know, journalist to the next. And when Friday afternoon arrived, you know, or end of the month arrived, I wouldn't be able to look back on a very, let's say, productive week or month in terms of my own research. And that would make me a bit sad that, you know, I had been pouring out expertise, but without getting new insight. So it is really a balance to strike here. And it is really about the balance.
But I guess your point is still quite controversial in regards to what impact actually is. Because when we see what we are being measured on in many universities, which is teaching, which is BFI production, we don't really have any place for this research communication side of it yet. Or where do you see that going? Are we getting there where we see some acknowledgement of research dissemination in impact?
Right. No, I think you're completely right. I mean, we do lack incentives and rewards for communication efforts. It's not, you know, it's not a large part. It's not an important, it's not an essential part of the reputational structure of science. We are getting more credit for, let's say, core contributions, which I guess is fair in a way, because we are scientists in the end of the day. So we should be judged by our contributions to science. And also some of these incentives and rewards are, you know, detrimental to broader impact. Because as you said, if you're a smart person, you know, which I guess many researchers fortunately are, you will look upon your incentive and reward structures, you know, and ask yourself, where will I get the most reward? Where will I enhance my ability to make progress in my career? And here, obviously, teaching and publication, you know, are seen as the primary drivers. But as I said before, it obviously also depends on your own, you know, psychology and your own profile, but you can prove this system wrong. So one thing is to start trying to change the incentive structures. You know, you can do that as soon as you become an associate professor or full professor and you're, you know, member of tenure and promotion assessment committees. You can actually start taking these contributions seriously by also including in your assessment of new candidates, their communication effort. I mean, this is up to personal judgment and personal leadership. But what you cannot do is you cannot, as an individual, change the regulation, change the university, you know, culture. But as I said before, and I think it's worth mentioning again, the moment you then start building, you know, communication efforts and also, you know, starting to see the outcome and starting to see the impact of your communication in your research. And the moment you're starting, you know, also to be able to document that by collecting a little bit of data, you know, by substantiating your communication with also, you know, trying to, yeah, create some evidence of the impact of that effort, then this will resonate with your, not only your peers, it will also resonate with your management. And in the end of the day, at least judging from my own career, I mean, it did resonate also with the funding agencies. So yeah, you might be right, it's controversial in the sense that you're a little bit running counter to your official career, you know, structure. But in the end of the day, proving that structure to be more, you know, inclusive for other types of outputs is also, I think, one of the most important tasks that we have in front of us.
I completely agree. So overall, do you have any kind of advice for researchers not being used to research dissemination and communication right now? Where should they start? Or should they wait and see what's going on right now?
Yeah, so I mean, okay, so first of all, I mean, I wouldn't encourage people to sit around waiting. So, you know, the old library model of universities is somewhat somehow like this. You know, we are sitting around as a library of knowledge and waiting for the customer to arrive at our door. And then we are going to borrow them a book if they ask, you know, interesting questions. And we are waiting for them, so to speak, to find us. But this library model does not work. You know, we're, as has been said many times before, we are living fortunately or unfortunately in an attention economy. So what you need to do is you need to get the attention of your stakeholders, both of your peers, but also of your stakeholders. So rather than sitting around waiting for people to find you, I would always encourage you as a researcher to try to find your own audience. So you should be a little bit more proactive. You know, people will not come and borrow a book and read it and thank you afterwards and, you know, and tell you that they took, you know, 20 pages of notes. This model is sort of dying out. I would even say unfortunately, but it's a fact of life. What you then need to do is you need to find your own audience. And you can do that also just in your everyday life. So every time you've been at a conference as a PhD student, as a postdoc, you know, write a small email to your department or to your research group saying, you know, I was at this conference, I met this researcher, we were discussing this. Is this of interest to any of you? You know, if you've been invited on board an expert committee or if you were invited to provide input to a different university, perhaps just, you know, try to experiment a little bit with social media. Say like, okay, something like, you know, the following. Today I'm visiting University of Umeå in Sweden. I'm giving a talk on XYZ. Well, then you already put it out there. So this might not be extensive period, you know, science communication in which you're putting out, you know, very technical details, but you're making sure that other people than yourself are knowing what you're doing. So just that simple fact, you know, to let your community know about your whereabouts and what you're working on by sharing some small insights is important. And then what I would, again, I guess this also follows from the same line of thought. What I would also say is what you would find often surprising is that people find it more interesting to become part of your research process rather than only getting to know about your research results. Mm-hmm. So if you're able to open up your research process, your dilemmas, your questions, your setbacks, and also, of course, your progress. And if you're taking your stakeholders and your peers and you know, your audience with you on a journey, you know, that's often what really resonates with people. Surprisingly enough, and there are good psychological research backing that, people are not that interesting in being told what is the truth and what is the truth only. People like to, you know, have an informed opinion. They like to be, held in the hand and taken on board a journey in which you'll slowly and progressively build a narrative around your research, saying, I'm doing research on this, it's super exciting. We are seeing, you know, other researchers coming into this area. There will be a new special issue out next year. You know, it's been a hassle to get it going, but now it's finally going. You know, put out those small bits and pieces of your research so that you're sharing your story, you're sharing your process. And, you know, I've been using Twitter and also to some extent LinkedIn for doing that. I'm not a big guy on Facebook because I thought it was too time consuming and it kind of turned more into a private communication tool rather than a professional one. But I know other researchers who have success also using Facebook. And, you know, then you start sharing your ideas, you start sharing your journey. And this is, at least from my own case, this is what I saw really was being picked up. And, you know, it also gives your peers and your audience a certain sense of humility. You know, you're not only flashing your results, you're not only flashing those 8 journal publications and keeping the rest to yourself, you're actually including other people in your research.
But I guess it can also be intimidating for some.
It can be, but you know, as scientists and researchers, we shouldn't be intimidated by rather engaging in debate or actually sharing our stories. And I think it's also important to notice or to mention that it shouldn't also be intimidating to share our setbacks. You know, you might sometimes, as a young researcher, see that if you're sharing some content, there might be an older, more senior professor commenting on your research or trying to put you in your right place or, you know, trying to, you know, teach you a lesson. But again, this is also part of the scientific process. We shouldn't be afraid if the senior professor is wrong, prove them wrong. You know, if they just want to comment because they want to hear their own voice, let them do it. But often what happens is that you won't take much damage. Rather, people will celebrate you for your courage. And in the end of the day, you will see that people are appreciating that you're opening up. You might open up about your setbacks. You might open up about your failures. You might even communicate negative results. Say, oh man, you know, we tried to produce results that should prove X, Y, Z, but we couldn't prove any of it. Our hypotheses were you know, abandoned in the end of the day. Well, that's an interesting finding. You know, that might even be a finding that you cannot write up in an academic journal article because the publishers won't publish it. But that's for sure something that your academic peers and even a wider audience would find interesting. And it also puts, let's say, a human face to the research research process. So it also incarnates you as a researcher. It builds you as a researcher. It builds your authority. So I think, you know, the time has come where researchers need to stand up for their research. Yes, you're right. You are right. It can be intimidating. But, you know, sit around at the desk and waiting for the new grant to be sent over by a funding agency and then have another 10 years of pure curiosity-driven, basic, free research. Well, sorry, it's not gonna happen.
No.
So if you wanna have a research career, you know, if you wanna build your authority within an academic field, I think it belongs to your job, basically, to also to communicate that. And then, as I said before, one of the key principles, it's almost an ethics of communication, is obviously to do that in a humble way, to be open for debate, you know, to engage in dialogue, and also don't inflate or oversell your research results. Don't make them look any better than they are. So that's also a really important part and principle of research communication. As I said before, open up the research process, also your setbacks, also your failures. The moment you start, you know, commercializing your research, the moment, you know, you start putting out advertisements for your research, people will immediately, you know, sense that this is about promotion rather than research communication. And again, you know, I hope it's not necessary to stress this, but the PR and, advertisement, it's not the same as science communication. Science communication is all about including other people, stakeholders, peers, in your scientific process. It's not about advertising final results.
And I guess that's also a part of building the competencies to do that and learning to find the right balance in it.
Well, it is. I mean, it is. It is about learning to find the right balance. And I'm not saying it's easy. You know, one of the things that I have been doing myself is to teach PhD classes on science communication. We were asked by the Innovation Foundation Denmark to have a class. Actually, that's a national research course for all the industrial PhDs on science communication. And you know, there we took the opportunity to try to get some of the competences across. How do you start? How do you pick out a piece of research that might be interesting? What shouldn't you do when you're communicating? And honestly, there are a lot of resources available out there. When you become part of an academic association or network, if you're part of a collaborative project, you often will see that there are other partners who knows better about communication. So you can ask them for good advice. And also, if you are in your early career, I mean, one of the things that I gained some experience by doing was also to co-author your communication or to co-produce communication with senior researchers. So I'm not saying that you should necessarily hide under their wings, but it's a good recommendation, you know, to see if there is a senior researcher in your group who's putting out research communication, you know, try to be part of it. Ask him or her, how can you contribute? Yes, you were the co-author of the paper, but you find yourself not to be the co-author of the opinion piece, or you find yourself not to be mentioned on the news article that the university publishes. So what that means is that you will start flying under the radar, that you won't get any follow-up questions, and that you won't be having the visibility in a way that you deserve. So you can start engaging with your own peers and in your own research environment. And then what I would also recommend early career researchers to do is to perhaps, you know, ask for comments, you know, ask for advice. So even today now I'm quite, you know, experienced in writing up, you know, press releases and newspaper articles or going on television news to give input. I do that regularly every week. But sometimes, you know, even for me, if it's an area that I don't feel, you know, too comfortable with, either I might say no, or, you know, pick up the phone, call a colleague and get a second opinion. You know, you shouldn't be too good to also acknowledge your weak points and to acknowledge, you know, your weak spots. So, you know, like next week, I have a piece in Politiken in Denmark about this ongoing debate about academic freedom and scientific activism in Denmark. And I'm trying to make a couple of controversial points. And this is not, you know, this is actually not core research in my own projects. This is kind of an opinion piece about science policy. But before sending it to Politiken, and now it actually only this morning got accepted for publication, I also had to send it to a couple of colleagues. I also had to get second opinions. And, you know, the colleagues responded very nicely that they thought this part was well written and this part could need more work. So last night I had to go back to the desk, back to the computer and rewrite it. So even though I put out, I guess, more than 100 of those opinion pieces in Danish and international media, I still, as of this today, need to get second opinions. So don't feel ashamed or don't feel, you know, that people will see your failures or that you aren't good enough. You just have to give it a shot.
I think that's a great ending note. Thank you so much for your time, David.
It was a pleasure being here.